Welcome to Cover Girls, Drinking and Overthinking, in which we take a story we love and analyze how well it was adapted.
I'm Chris.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Allison. Join us as we meticulously pick apart our favorite stories until no stone is left unturned. It'll be bookish.
It'll be boozy.
It'll be bantersome.
And it won't be boring. So grab a drink and get ready to overthink. Let's dig in. Hey!
Hey!
Hey! How are you guys?
Honestly, loving life, doing great.
Well, yeah, you just finished a pretty nice drink.
I sure did.
I am living for the screensaver on your computer behind you. You have like the most beautiful pictures of your little baby. Who's with her there?
That's her cousin Oliver.
Aww.
Yeah.
Cute.
Yeah. He's about a year older than, a year and a half older than her.
Tell the listeners how old Emmy is. Brag on her for a second. She's the cutest baby I've ever seen.
She is going to be 2 at the beginning of July. She's literally growing so fast, like I can't keep up. She says new words every single day. She sings whole songs. She can say the alphabet. She can count to 10.
And she's not 2? Good for her.
Yeah. Yeah. She's we think she's smart. I know all parents think their kids
right.
are smart.
Yeah.
I think she's smart.
I think she's smart.
Yeah. The daycare teacher said that yesterday she was just like playing around with Emmy and she was talking to her in Spanish and she said like butterfly is like mariposa. Mm. And so she asked, like she said that to Emmy and Emmy said, mariposa?
Wow.
And the teacher was like, she said it perfectly.
Cute.
Like, she, not that she knows what it means, but.
You have a great opportunity to make her like fluent, in, like to make her bilingual.
I would love for her to learn Spanish at a young age, but they do teach some Spanish at this daycare.
Nice.
So yeah.
I wish I was bilingual. Like I know
too.
I can understand Spanish better than I could speak it, but God, I wish I was fluent. That'd be amazing. Or close.
Very useful. Yeah.
Well, before we move on, I want to know, what is your favorite word that she's learned or like the funniest one?
Well, I love that she's learned some words, but she doesn't say them correctly. So we've accidentally gotten some like naughty words said.
Oh, of course.
Because she's trying, like, for example, she tries to pronounce sock and it comes out with a C instead of an S. She's also said, I think she's trying to say sit, but she'll say shit.
I've heard her do that before. Yeah.
Yeah. And so those are some of my favorites. But then, of course, mommy has to be one of my favorites.
So. Top 3 for sure.
It's really, really hard for me to remember what it felt like to be a kid, as I think it is for like most people. But I feel like it's particularly hard for me. I'm just such an adult through and through now that it's hard for me to have that lens that makes life so exciting and new and fresh. And I feel like I get to relive that through your kid, who is, of course, my niece, if anyone doesn't know. But when I'm around Emmy, I feel like a kid again. It's great.
You know, I was actually yesterday, I saw a clip of Mr. Rogers on Johnny Carson from years and years ago.
Aww.
And he said something similar to what you just said, Allison. And that's that, because I think Johnny Carson said, or no, I'm sorry. I saw 2 different clips of Mr. Rogers yesterday. This was the Oprah one.
Oh, okay. I didn't know she was on Oprah.
Oprah said, it's really hard to remember what it's like through their eyes and to have all the little feelings that they have. And Mr. Rogers said, yes, but you get to experience that again through when you're watching them and living with them, you're seeing it through their eyes. And it's very special to reconnect with your childhood in that way. And I think as we read this book, sometimes it's hard to remember that they're kids, right? We said that in the last episode. It can be hard to remember that they're not going to think the same way we do because they may have a much more optimistic view of the world. Like when, I don't remember which kid it was like, maybe the lake will fill up and we can go swimming.
Yeah.
Like very naive and very sweet.
Yeah.
But you lose that as you get older.
Totally. We just become more jaded.
We do.
It's hard for me to feel genuine excitement, you know, these days, which I'm trying to channel for this podcast. Like, this movie was such an exciting one to watch when I was a kid. And that song, like we've talked about, I listened to it before we recorded today. And it got me so pumped.
I'm just so sad it's not on Spotify.
I know. It's a bummer.
Yeah, I have to go through YouTube. Which is a bummer because there's ads because I don't want to pay for YouTube Red.
Why don't you have an ad blocker?
Would an ad blocker prevent YouTube ads?
It does. It doesn't work on your phone, but on your on a computer it will.
So I don't have to pay for YouTube Red if I just have an ad blocker?
Yeah.
The world just opened up in Lin, you know, Miranda, Lin-Manuel.
You heard it here first, guys.
Yep. Scattering my pearls of wisdom everywhere.
Okay, I'm so excited to get into this episode.
Yay!
I'm really excited to reveal the drinks. I'm always excited to reveal the drinks. It's my favorite part. So, Kristen, why don't you go first?
I am sticking with what I do best, which is a diet soda. I was telling the girls before we started recording, that's basically all I drink is sparkling water and diet soda. And no, I am not accepting critiques of my diet at this time.
Like you, Kristen, I get tired of the, it'll give you brain tumors.
There is actually no conclusive proof whatsoever in any study that it gives you any kind of cancer. And if it is, I'm taking that risk. Delicious cancer.
Also, everybody has their vices. Everybody. If I could be clapping without it being in the audio, I would be doing that. Everybody has their vices.
Yes, they do.
And I think that Diet Coke and Coke Zero are the least of.
I could be chugging meth right now.
Yeah. Is that what we do? We chug it? I don't know how meth works.
I'm not the expert on hard drugs either.
That's what the children do. They're drinking their meth.
They're drinking it.
Their methane.
Sure, they don't just smell it and get high. I don't know.
To be perfectly honest with you, no, I'm not.
I genuinely do not know how it works. So listeners, goodness. If you know how meth works, let us know.
I know you smoke meth, but yes. I know there are other ways to do it. And I don't know. Can you shoot
meth? For some reason, I thought that crystal meth was what you smoked.
Yeah,
I think you can put it into a shampoo. And,
what?
I'm making that up.
Oh, I believed you.
You can put it in your butt. Unfortunately, people do that.
Yeah, that works for everything.
You could put your meth in there. That's Adam Sandler in
Hot Chick.
Yeah. You can put your weed in there.
Wow.
It's not a good impression, but
I forgot about that.
Oh my god. Okay, Chris, tell us about your drink.
I am drinking Yellowtail Cabernet. I thought of it sort of being connected to this book in the sense that it's Yellowtail, which is an Australian wine. And I always think of their Outback, which is like super hot, super dry. Then it's also Yellowtail, which reminds me of the yellow spotted lizard again. So there you go.
You know, something like anytime I see Yellowtail, which I don't really drink, I've got nothing against it. It's just not what I pick up at the store. But when I see it, I think of our dad. For some reason, I remember him drinking Yellowtail when I was a kid.
This is like the first time I've bought Yellowtail Cab probably in my adult life.
Wow.
And I immediately thought of our dad.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm really excited to introduce my drink. First of all, Chris, you can check out my koozie. This has nothing to do with it.
Yes.
But it is a Tito's koozie. And,
Tito's, if you would like to sponsor us, we're available.
Yes. If you didn't catch it on one of the earlier episodes, Chris's husband works for Tito's.
He sure does. He works with Tito's.
Okay. Yeah. He does.
Advertising.
Advertising. I almost said marketing, and they're very different.
Very different.
Advertising.
Yes. Advertising. Yes.
But what's inside the koozie? This is a Lone River Ranch Rita. So no, we are not sponsored by Lone River, but I really love them. And I sometimes do work for them, which is why I have this. So Lone River is a ranch water, and it's the margarita version of the ranch water. So this is like a cocktail in a can. It's a very light type of margarita. So first I thought very simply margarita because it's nice on a hot Texas, you know, afternoon. But Lone River itself, the ranch water, comes from far west Texas, where ranch water originated. And this is the only brand to actually be made in far west Texas, where ranch water came from, or at least that I know of. And so Lone River, it's called that because that is the river by legend where ranch water originated. So since Holes is set in far west Texas, I figured this was incredibly appropriate. I'm going to crack it open here. Oh, I'm going to give you some ASMR. Here we go.
Mm. Oh, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
Ooh.
Cheers, gals.
Sexy. Cheers.
So all right. Good. All right.
So, shall we hop in?
Yes, we have to stop saying dig in. So we will hop in, dive in. Actually, dive could be accurate because there's a lake and they find some water in these chapters. I don't know.
Finally.
So we're starting with chapter 31. We'll see how far we get. Hoping for 50 pages. It's very ambitious with how many tangents we go on, but we will try. So we start off at camp. And Stanley's digging his hole. I want to, again, point out how self-aware, you know, obviously we get much more from the characters in the book because we're in their heads and you can't always translate that to a film medium. But it says, regarding Caveman, he knew he never should have let Zero dig part of his hole because he's suffering the ramifications. He still could have taught him to read. If Zero could dig all day and still have the strength to learn, then he should have been able to dig all day and still have the strength to teach. Which it is hard to have that strength for either of them after this long day. But I think that's really self-aware to go, okay, wait, it takes just as much effort to learn as it does to teach. And he's able to do both. I could have done both.
And bless Stanley's heart. I had sort of been thinking it earlier. I was like, well, you could still teach him and dig your own hole. But I also understand how absolutely like exhausting it is out there. I would argue that Zero is in better shape than Stanley and that Stanley has to exert more effort to dig a hole because he's not conditioned. I mean, we get to the point where he talks about how much weight he's lost, right? I mean, he's smaller than he was when he first arrived, but it was very clear that he was not cut out for manual labor when he got there. So he may have ended up being more exhausted at the end of the day if he had continued that way.
Another crucial difference is that Zero really wanted to learn. We're told he's smiling, he's excited. So he's doing something he wants to do, which gives you energy. Stanley is doing something that he does not feel that he's good at and that he doesn't want to do, both of which sap your energy.
Yes, that's a good point.
Oh, Jinx, you owe me a Coke Zero.
I only take Diet Coke.
Well, you're the one who owes me one, so I'll take a Coke Zero. Next time we jinx, I'll give you a Diet Coke. Okay, so as we addressed before, Stanley is already thinking about God's thumb. He's seen it. It's in the back of his head. And now, to catch you all up on where we left off, listeners, Zero has run away with no water. And Caveman is thinking about God's thumb. Will Zero make it there? And through the next few pages, he's feeling extreme guilt. He is feeling constantly like he should go after Zero every hour of the day. He's thinking, I should go after him. No, what good will it do? No, I'll never find him. No, he's going to die anyway or come back. That's how it's going to go. And he's suffering some extreme guilt here, like a responsibility for Zero.
Yes.
And we get to the part where we mentioned it earlier in the last episode, but the kids really are afraid that the warden will scratch them with her rattlesnake venom. And that's what he's afraid of if he goes after Zero and then comes back or whatnot, or if he goes and tells the warden what's going on. He's very afraid of her.
Well, specifically, because I know we talked last time about the possibility that the kids in general knew about it. And it seems like Stanley's the only one who knows about her rattlesnake fingers.
Maybe so.
Stanley's biggest fear is that if he brings Zero back, she will scratch them. That's the scariest thing he can think of.
And he was too afraid of Mr. Sir to tell anybody what had happened to Mr. Sir.
Yep.
Right. So maybe this is privileged information for Caveman specifically.
Yeah.
The next morning, the next day, Zero still has not returned. Mr. Pendanski still being an a-hole. Okay. And so then we get to this scene that was done differently in the movie where they're talking about Zero not coming back and erasing his files because no one will miss him because he's a ward of the state. And I want to know if you think this adds anything in the book here. And I think they have to do it this way because it's from Caveman's point of view. Caveman is here. They're in his tent when he gets there, and they're wanting to know from Caveman, have you seen Zero? Has he come to you? And then the conversation unfolds about, oh, he's probably going to die out there. Mr. Bendanski is like, no one cares about him. He's a ward of the state. No one will come looking. Do you think that Caveman being there makes much of a difference, and why?
Oh, gosh, I hadn't even really thought about that.
Being in there as opposed to what?
Because I'm pretty sure in the movie he was not in the scene at all. The adults were having this conversation without him.
Yeah, they were having it like in the office, I think, by themselves.
No, specifically in that scene, they're cleaning up Zero's bunk because they don't want anybody to know that he was there. They're cleaning up all of his stuff. And one of them says, Pendanski says, nobody cares about Hector Zeroni. And we know that Stanley's listening because right then Stanley walks in and says, I care.
Oh, that's a really good point. Okay.
So same locale, but in the book it implies that they are waiting. They're there because they're waiting for Caveman. They want to ask him, like pump him for information.
Yes.
And include him in the discussion.
Yeah. They think that, well, they probably know correctly that if Zero came back, Caveman's the first one they would talk to.
Yeah.
Right. Do y'all think it makes any difference with Caveman being there and them consulting him and like trying to pump him for information and discussing these adult things in front of him and saying like actually discussing their master plan in front of this kid, like we're going to erase his files.
To me, there's a lot of recklessness on their parts. Even if Zero hadn't run away and he had survived and made it to another penitentiary, like into adulthood and then got out, all of these kids know what's going on at this camp. Like, eventually one of them is going to talk to someone who listens.
Right.
Like, and it's one thing for the adults to know that, like, there are harsh conditions there, but it's incredibly reckless to talk about erasing someone from the system and letting a child die in the desert. That's a whole nother level. Yeah.
Anything from you, Kristen?
Just that I don't buy either in the movie or in the book that you can, from a PC in, when is this? 90...
Ooh, I don't even know what year it is.
98. It was written in 98 or published in 98. I don't buy for a second that a random PC out in the middle of nowhere in 98 is able to hack into state files, especially somebody like Pendanski doing it.
Right.
Yeah. I don't think Pendanski could.
Guys, side note, because you were talking about the author and I almost wanted to say his name and realized we were debating about how to say his name earlier. And I looked it up and it is Lewis, but the last name very unintuitively is pronounced Sacker.
Sacker.
Oh, Sacker. Okay.
So, Lewis Sacker. Just so you know.
Okay.
Good. That's good to know.
So we get to chapter 32, and this is Twitch's introduction. First of all, just like the movie, he gets his nickname literally in the first sentence of his introduction. You know, he's called Twitch because he twitches when he's around a nice car that he wants to steal. But I realized, okay, first of all, immediately after his introduction, the next page, Stanley's about to steal the car. And it was very clear to me in the book that Twitch's presence is entirely intentional just to give Caveman the idea and ability to steal the car.
Yes.
So he thinks of it because Twitch is talking about stealing cars. And then when he's in the car, you know, something I hadn't thought of is this kid is like 14. He's never driven. So he's really nervous about it. And when he gets in, he actually doesn't know what gear to put it in. He doesn't understand anything. And Twitch has to call out to him, change the gear, like put it in drive. And so... In this, through this lens, reading the book, it becomes very clear why Twitch is there.
It also becomes very clear why Stanley wrecks the truck.
Yes, let's talk about it. Go for it, Chris.
Well, I mean, there. All I was really going to say is he doesn't know what he's doing at all. Like, he's so focused on trying to drive, like the act of how do I get this truck to drive. And less of where do I go? What do I need to look out for? Like, how much gas do I give? Like, he just careens right into a hole. And I feel like it's much more understandable reading it in the book than it is in the movie.
I agree.
Well, in the movie, the reason he crashes is because he's looking back at his friends and waving at them.
Yes, and we gave him such a hard time when we dissected the movie. He just simply crashes into a hole because there are a ton and he's never driven a car before. Like,
yeah.
And he's probably too short to really see above the windshield.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Oh, that's a great point, actually. Didn't even think of that. Because it is a big old truck.
Yeah. So he wouldn't be able to see the hole.
And I want to backpedal for just a second. There is a quote here on 146, halfway, just above halfway through, where it's Caveman thinking about Zero. He thinks about him a lot. They develop this relationship really, really well in the book. Lewis Saker does. And he says, what if Zero was still alive, desperately crawling across the dirt, searching for water? And this image comes into his mind a few times. And it's pretty brutal if you imagine actually a close friend you have dying from dehydration slowly out in the brutal heat on the hot, dry ground. Like, and you could, not necessarily that he could do something about it, like save him, but you're choosing to not go after him at all and just leave him. You know, like, I understand the guilt a lot more here and I understand their bond better.
I felt like the book really developed their relationship more than the movie did. I mean, not that it wasn't well done in the movie too. It's just on another level here in the book.
Totally.
You can really understand what's going through Caveman's mind as he's, I mean, I felt like it almost happened immediately that he went after Zero in the movie. But here, there's so much thought that goes into it.
Yeah, it says that right before, like when he's thinking of stealing the truck, I loved the way Saker painted this picture because it feels very relatable. He's thinking about taking the truck. He took another deep breath. Think about this, he told himself, but there wasn't time to think. He flung open the door to the truck and just climbed inside. And he was debating for a bit before that, but he recognized, if I'm going to do it, right now is the only moment where I will get away with it. Like, I have to, whether it's a stupid decision or not, whether it's logical or not, this is my only chance to do it. So I just have to make a decision in this split second. And I've been there so many times. Like, I don't have time to think if this is smart or not, but it's my only chance to execute it. Just got to do it or not.
Look, I do that all the time in like hearings,
in
meetings. I mean, there are times when you just have to make a decision on which way you're going to go with something. And you know, it could be the wrong decision, but you just got to commit to it.
I thought it was really relatable, honestly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially when you're doing something you know is bad on some level. Like, it's wrong to steal someone's truck. You are going to get in trouble if you get caught. There are definitely consequences to this action. And you just have to buck up and do it or not. So he does it.
Without water.
Yeah. Well, so he drives the truck hoping that it could bring the water to Zero, which obviously doesn't work out. And then he brings this up later, but I thought of it right away, and I'm sure y'all did too. He's already far away from everyone when he crashes the truck and runs off without filling his canteen, which is already empty. He has the water next to him. It bothered me because I'm like, oh my God, no one's going to come grab you before you fill your canteen. Just fill it. But I have to put myself in a child's shoes who's scared and running on adrenaline and thinking, I just got to run. They're not thinking about the facts and looking back like, how close are they? Could I stand here for 15 seconds and fill my canteen to prepare for the journey?
I don't think it's that illogical, actually. I mean, watching the movie or, you know, or reading the book, you're like, oh, for God's sake, get water. But firstly, the last thing Stanley saw when somebody ran away was a bunch of grown men pulling guns.
Right.
The warden is not here to say, for the love of God, don't shoot. And most importantly, he says he glanced back at Mr. Sir so he can still see Mr. Sir, who remained where he was staring at Stanley. So not only is he close enough to see Mr. Sir, he can see what Mr. Sir is looking at. He's not that far away.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Kristen. I did not, when I was reading this, I did not see an opportunity for filling the canteen. Really? If I had been in Stanley's shoes, I would have
booked it.
Because I also had the impression that Mr. Sir could have taken off after him and chose not to.
Right. So he managed to get to his feet. He was sore. This is after he crashes. He was sore, but didn't think he had broken any bones because the airbag went off. He glanced back at Mr. Sir, who remained where he was, staring at Stanley. I'm like, he's not running after him, but it would have been a ballsy move. Like, hey, see you standing there. Watch me fill my canteen. What are you going to do?
Well, yeah.
Yeah. I think, and maybe it's because I'm like not much of a risk taker, but I would have been like, it's like when you're watching a horror movie and you're like, just get out of there. Like, don't be the person that like has to go back for your stuff. Like, just go. Mm-hmm.
So he's, you know, off and running, and he runs far enough where he comes upon holes that obviously don't have a system, and they're just very random. Whereas like back at camp, the warden would say, okay, we're digging in this area now, dig these like 3 feet apart or whatnot. But you can see that he's headed all the way out to where the hole started. So we're getting further and further from camp. Says Stanley found himself looking down into each hole he passed. He didn't admit to himself what he was looking for, which I believe means Zero's dead body.
Yes.
Which is very heavy. We don't get this heaviness in the movie. So he eventually finds a bag that looks like Mr. Sir's sunflower seeds. So Mr. Sir must have been around a long time, actually, if his sunflower seeds are way back where the holes...
Right at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And he turned the sack inside out and found one seed stuck to the burlap lunch. That's how the chapter ends.
Also means that Mr. Sir has been quitting smoking for quite a while.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So who knows how long he's been going back and forth.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's usually how it
trying
goes.
To quit for years, yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know what? Good on him for still trying. At least he doesn't just give up entirely. Honestly, yeah, if I worked in a camp like that, I would take any vice.
Like Allie said earlier, we all have our vices.
Oh my God, you just called me Allie.
Sorry, everyone.
On the podcast. My sister does call me Allie. Oh, now if we ever get big, people are going to just start calling me that just to antagonize me. Chapter 34. He's still out wandering around. He thinks he sees a puddle of water, but it's a mirage, so it's really hot and he's really tired. But, I can't wait to bring this up. I haven't been able to wait to bring this up. This is so exciting. I love seeing these survival instincts from Stanley and Zero. We don't see this in the movie, but he's constantly thinking of how to survive out in this wasteland. So he still carries the burlap sack with him from the sunflower seeds, even though he has no use for it. Yet, he's like, I might need it. Who knows what I might need to put in it? And we will continue to see them saving things they might need. And I'm excited to get into that more further, just because I'm not a survivalist myself, but I would like to be. It interests me. I do like to camp and backpack mildly. This is something that really, really interests me and I appreciate. So I love that the God's Thumb, it's like much more prevalent in Caveman's mind in the books here. That's his goal the whole time. He's always walking towards God's Thumb. And every time he looks at it, it seems to encourage him, giving him the thumbs up sign. And this becomes a cute little thing between him and Zero that
I really missed that wasn't in the movie.
I know. I thought it was so cute.
I'm curious about that exclusion because, yeah, we see them throughout their trek, as, you know, we'll see later on. Anytime they want to encourage each other, they give each other a little thumbs up, which is very apropos, and I was kind of bummed that for whatever reason they didn't include that in the movie.
Me too. It's adorable. And actually, these next couple chapters, we're going to see just how deep and genuine and sweet their relationship is. And I'm so excited. So he does happen upon the Mary Lou, the Mary Lou or whatever he calls it. Just as he does.
Mary Lou.
Yeah, Mary Lou. Just like he does in the movie. And
so here's something I realized not until I got to this section of the book. So obviously in the book, she does not die. Patricia Rissette, kissing Kate Barlow, does not die near the boat. She does not go back to the boat to die. She just dies wandering randomly in the lake. In the movie, she goes back to the boat. She waits for a lizard. She lets it bite her, which we kind of get the idea was her plan all along. And then she dies, which means that in the movie, we should have seen her skeleton.
Yeah, that is something I've often thought about. I was even thinking about it when I was rereading this. And like, are we
dry conditions pretty good? I mean, there are animals out there, but
yeah, that's the only thing I could think of.
Or worms. It's actually like a pretty good. Well, it's hot, but it's
actually
dry.
Yeah. So, okay, I was immediately impressed by this deduction. I had not thought of that at all. But now that I'm thinking about it, coyotes are definitely out there. And I do think that with a freshly decomposing corpse, they would come, like, pick it apart and drag it off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would think, too.
Especially if it's not protected. Like, maybe if she was under the boat. And who knows? Maybe she... No, she dies on the spot there.
Yeah, she dies right there. Yeah.
Yeah. So chapter 35, Stanley does find Zero at the boat. And, ooh, this was a grotesque... Interesting quote. Zero's face looked like a jack-o'-lantern that had been left out too many days past Halloween, half rotten with sunken eyes and a drooping smile.
Like, he's in bad shape, y'all. That was like, that was visceral for me.
Mm-hmm. Me too. Darker than I was expecting, again, from this children's book. So Stanley has no water, neither does he, but Zero invites him in to have some sploosh, and Stanley can only fit in because he's lost a lot of weight. And we realize that, like, when he asks how many are left, Zero says none. He just didn't even question sharing his last jar of resources, water/food, both, mostly hydration. Mm-hmm. That's the scariest part. He just shared it with Stanley, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was really sweet. There's a part of me that's like, that's stupid. Talk about your resources, discuss it first.
But to be fair, Stanley was probably in pretty bad shape.
He
probably needed it at that point just to keep going.
And also, Caveman, again, hitting me with how smart he is, at least like street smart for a kid. He notices the jars and, you know, that they're under the boat and that they have to be X amount old, so like over 100 years. And he's like, who knew what kind of bacteria might be living in it? I don't know if at 14 I'd really be like thinking this, but he goes on to like understand bacteria quite well.
Yeah.
You know? Later on, he's like, oh, well, maybe since I only ate from the jar that was really, really well sealed that we couldn't open, then it being that tightly sealed means that bacteria couldn't get in it. So maybe I won't get sick. It's like, wow, I don't think I was.
See, to me, that makes sense because at 14, you've just freshly come out of science class. Like, he might not be thinking about that kind of thing all the time, but he's only been out there, we learned, for less than 2 months. Yeah, less than 2 months. He's been there for 45 days-ish.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a kid fresh out of school. You have all these concepts fresh in your brain, which is why, you know, the show Are You Smarter Than the Fifth Grader exists, which is not to say that he's not smart. I think it's really cool that he brings that up. But again, I think it's more indicative of the fact that we're seeing the world from a kid's perspective because something like that is so immediate in his mind, which I like.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think maybe I just wasn't very good at science, so I didn't understand things like bacteria and like how colds and sicknesses work and viruses. Like, I think it's taken my adult life like trying to understand that to really get it. So maybe I'm a little bit more or like behind the curve in that way. But we get to the end of the chapter. And Stanley asks him, what does that look like? So Zero refuses to go back. He doesn't care if he's going to die. He's not going back. So Stanley's got to stay with him. And he's like, okay, I guess we're going to God's Thumb. And asks Zero, what does that mountain look like? And Zero holds up the thumbs up sign. And I'm wondering how obvious it is that it looks like a thumbs up, or if this is kind of destiny that these two individuals uniquely see the thumbs up sign, you know?
Hmm. Yeah, I guess we don't really have any way of knowing that because we never hear it described from any other person's perspective. Nobody else ever mentions it.
Except Stanley's grandfather, or great-great-grandfather.
Right. Well, of the people who have seen it.
Right.
We only have these two's descriptions. So, yeah, I guess we can't know because we're only seeing through the two people tied together by destiny.
Got no idea. So, we're in chapter 36, and
We mention that Zero was sick?
No.
I don't know. Yeah, he's getting sicker and sicker, and we're never really given a reason why. Like, we're not sure if it's the sploosh that's making him sick or the proximity to his familial curse. We don't really know.
You know, it's weird because in the movie, I got the impression that he didn't start getting sick until he cut his hand, and I thought that it was like an infection that was making him sick.
Mm.
And in the book, it seems like he gets sick earlier on.
Yeah, he starts getting sick and feeling pain almost immediately after Caveman gets... Or no, he even... I think in both, he's been getting sick even before that. He says something about how he's been getting sick.
I did always think it was from the sploosh. I think that Caveman's right that some bacteria did get into some of the jars, no matter how good they tasted. So that was always my impression.
Okay. So maybe, maybe I just missed that.
But they don't explicitly say it by any means.
Yeah.
But I do immediately love, again, these survival instincts. The beginning of chapter 36 is they put four of the unbroken jars in the burlap sack in case they might be able to use them. I'm like, yeah, you never know when you might need like something to hold something in, which they later use for water. And Zero says, when you spend your whole life living in a hole, the only way you can go is up. Sad, but true.
Very sad.
And this is the first time they give each other the thumbs up.
Oh, yeah.
Their little code.
Yeah, it's their way of encouraging each other, which is like so cute. This whole journey is about mental fortitude. So he does say, you know, he wished he'd filled his canteen before scooting off, which, you know, I was thinking too, but I understand why he didn't. Zero's insides, are just destroying him, which I find super relatable. Like, this is even more scary than what I went through in Colorado. I did a backpacking trip there, and my very first night at the top of this, like, 11,500 foot elevation mountain, like, far away. There's no cell service. No one else is staying up there. We're in the middle of nowhere with bears and mountain lions. And I got sick my first night. I had a fever. I was shivering. My boyfriend at the time, like, was taking care of me, but he was worrying, like, am I going to have to, like, call a, like, hike down 2 miles to try to call, like, a helicopter or whatever? And I was like, no, don't do that. I'm sure I'll get through it. But there was that fear of, what if I don't get better? There's no one around. Like, I'm literally in the middle of nowhere at the will of, like, biology, or at the mercy of biology, you know? And this is even more scary. This guy's going to die.
Yeah. Well, as far as they, I mean, obviously we're not quite sure what's going on with the stomach, but like in general, lack of food, lack of water. At this point, it's not even about pride. They very well might not be able to make it back.
Totally.
Oh, and I know we had already skipped past this, I think, but I actually thought it was kind of impressive that Stanley had the foresight to understand that he could only go half as far as he thought he could, because he'd also have to have the energy to get back to the camp earlier when he was actually like thinking he'd have to go back. I thought, well, that's kind of impressive. Cause as a kid, I don't know. I think most kids would just be like, I'm just going to keep going till I'm tired. Then I'll turn around.
Exactly.
You know,
he's got incredible foresight.
Yeah. He has really good instincts.
Absolutely. No, he's a smart kid. I just keep realizing it more and more in the book, which I didn't really see in the movie.
Because we can't hear his internal dialogue in the movie.
Which is what's so beautiful about being able to read the book. This is why we do this, right?
Yeah.
So, something else I found really relatable is they're trying to make it towards Big Thumb, and he makes a mental snapshot of how it looks, and then looks down, doesn't look at it while he's walking, and tries to wait 10 minutes before looking at it again to see if it seems closer, because it never seems closer. But if I wait long enough, I might see it a little closer. And I do this all the time at work, like with a really long shift. Sometimes I'll work like a 13-hour day. And it's like, so if you start looking at your watch in the first 4 hours, like, good luck.
Yeah.
But eventually, you know, I get to a point where I'm like, okay, if I can just wait to look at my watch for like half, just wait as long as possible, then when I look at it again, I'll be really happy that I'm that much further into my shift.
Yep.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I do that too, actually. The same thing with like work and looking at the clock in the late afternoon. Because I swear if I keep looking, I'll think an hour has gone by and it's been 15 minutes.
Totally. Yep.
That's the worst. That's the worst.
Totally. So, page 162, Zero's really not doing well. He's fallen over. Oh, and Caveman starts to look at the shovel, and it says he couldn't help but think that he might need it to dig a grave. Zero's last hole. And then the thought, dig a grave for me. This is dark, y'all.
It's real bleak. My guy. For kids, yeah.
And then Zero does get up, once again flashing his thumbs up. Like, he's on the brink of death, basically. He's completely depleted. But he's like, no, I'm going to keep going, and gives the thumbs up. It's so cute.
He's just a sweet little boy, and I love him.
He is.
And his only way to get through this is, he says, give me some words. He's got to refocus his brain. Like, let me try to spell. Let me try to sound it out. So they go through some words. It's really sweet. They're doing a really good job this whole time of like keeping each other motivated. Caveman knows that however weak and exhausted he is, Zero feels 10 times worse. So as long as Zero can keep going, he can keep going too. I'm like, yes, that's true. Way to keep yourself motivated and way to be realistic. Zero's really going through it. If he can do it, you can do it.
Mm-hmm. What really made me sad too is, again, Stanley is always like worrying about other people. And he said what worried him the most was the thought of his parents not knowing what happened to him, not knowing whether he was dead or alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a gut punch.
Yeah.
Totally. And my next thought.
Go ahead.
Jinx.
You go. I was just going to say, we start to see weeds. We start to see gnats, both of which can't exist without a teensy tiny bit of water.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Caveman starts to realize this eventually. Weeds, bugs, there has to be water, which again is very astute. I don't know if as a 14-year-old, I would think that way. I'm pretty impressed by him. Like now, of course I would. But
oh, yeah.
I don't know. He has a lot of like street knowledge for someone so young. Like he's very practical. And there's a couple pages of them just really, again, beautifully motivating each other. It's so cute how it ebbs and flows with them trying to keep each other motivated, even though they have no water. This is a treacherous, like the journey seems more treacherous in the book than it does in the movie.
It does.
Well, especially, I mean, it goes on for, hang on, let me just, 4 whole chapters are more or less just them walking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's before he gets to Zero.
Right.
And then there's another 2 whole chapters of just Stanley walking.
Yeah.
So.
And okay, I had a question here. I started to realize like they're really good at motivating each other, but wouldn't an incredible motivation be for Stanley to tell Zero about his family's history and that he had a great grandfather who found refuge on God's thumb and like survived up there?
You know, that's a really good point.
Because he doesn't tell him.
Yeah, like why he's so intent on getting to the top of God's thumb. Like that's what's keeping him encouraged.
Right.
I don't know that he doesn't tell him. I don't know why we're not privy to it, but I don't know that he doesn't tell him. Because I think my 2 cents is that the book skips his explanation, and I don't know why, but at the end of chapter 35, he says, what does it look like to you? Zero realizes it looks like a thumb. And then the next thing Stanley says is, I should warn you, I'm not exactly the luckiest guy in the world. They're like basically getting provisions together. And then later at some point, Zero says, what do you think's up there? And Stanley looks at Big Thumb and says, oh, probably an Italian restaurant. I'll get a pizza and a root beer. So I think they've had that conversation, but I think my take on it is because he's very economical with his words. And I think he has told Zero, but he's not telling us again because he knows we already know. That's my 2 cents.
I honestly don't agree, mostly because, first of all, I just think that they would have somehow, like Saker would have somehow, you know, briefed us like with one sentence, like, and then he told, you know, Zero this and that. But also because he says, I must warn you, I'm very unlucky, as if it's news. And him being unlucky is part of the story. Like that, like yeah, if he'd already told the story, Zero would know why he's unlucky and that he's unlucky.
Mm.
That could be too.
But yeah, like it's new information.
I probably tend to agree with you more, Allison. At least that was my impression upon reading this chapter, was that he still had not shared it with Zero.
Yeah, either way, whether he did or didn't, I would have liked to see it, you know? So Zero gets this happens just like the movie. He gets the gashes in his hands trying to pull Stanley up, which is like heartbreaking. And then we get to 37 and they really are almost there. Like after days and days, like Kristen pointed out, it's taken a long time. And I loved this sentence. I thought this was really interesting. It became too steep to go straight up. Instead, they zigzagged back and forth, increasing their altitude by small increments every time they changed directions. The use of the word zigzag, it unlocked something in me. I was like, oh, that's why Zigzag has his nickname, because of his volatile personality shifts.
Ooh, okay. I hadn't caught on to that.
Perhaps. I don't know. That's what it made me think that.
Could be.
Because I don't really know why he's called Zigzag.
It did seem that he was a little off his rocker. Mm-hmm. So that sort of adds up with what you're saying.
I don't know. I mean, that unlocked something in my brain. And I don't know. That'd be cool if that's why that's his nickname. Because he's very volatile and up and down. So Stanley asks how Zira's doing, even when he's close to freaking... He is E in the tank, and he is close to not making it, and he still gives a thumbs up. But then he jokes, if a gnat lands on me, it'll knock me over.
I thought that was funny. It's cute.
They make jokes the whole time. It's just really sweet to watch them together under dire circumstances, being like taking care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then... Stanley, they're doing, like, spelling stuff to get through it, and Zero passes out or whatever, like, falls down. And after 15 minutes after Stanley gave him the last word, which is lunch, he says lunch, which shows me that there's always something going on in his head. For 15 minutes, he's been stewing on this, even though he's, like, passing out and stuff. And it's like the opposite of the name everyone's coined for him. They say Zero is going on in his head, but like there's always something going on in his head.
Mm-hmm. So then poor Zero, still sick, throws up at the word lunch, which was sort of, you know, ironic. But then they make the observation, Stanley does, that there's weeds and bugs and that there has to be water somewhere. They're getting close.
And then Zero falls. Mm-hmm. And Stanley has to pick him up. And he says, come on, weeds and boogs, which Zero had accidentally pronounced bugs as boogs. And he says, I already ordered your hot fudge sundae. They're making it right now. And Zero's passed out and says nothing. But now he has him draped over his shoulder, this tiny little thing, and is carrying him up the mountain. Which made me think, oh, was there always a point to Caveman being really big and Zero being extra small? Was the point that Caveman was always meant to be big enough to carry, like, two guys of the same size, carrying a person of your same weight and size up a freaking mountain is really hard.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it would seem like it would make more sense given the physical descriptions in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or maybe that's why Zero had to be so extra tiny in the movies. Because Shia LaBeouf is not a big guy.
No.
That too. So we start getting a lot more Destiny, you know, peppered in here, like references to Destiny. Stanley says the strength came from somewhere deep inside himself as he carried Hector up the mountain. It also seemed to come from the outside as well. After focusing on Big Thumb for so long, it was as if the rock had absorbed his energy and now acted like a kind of giant magnet pulling him toward it. So that just sounds like Destiny to me.
Yeah, there's Destiny all over this. And we recognize Sam's secret onion farm.
Mm-hmm.
Because the one thing that they keep repeating is they can't possibly find water. He's realizing now that we can't possibly find water because, of course, there can't be water at the top of a rock because water can't flow uphill. And just as he realizes that, he lands in the mud.
Mm-hmm. They make it up, basically, and they're so exhausted that right as they get to the top-ish, Caveman slips, Zero's already knocked out, and now they're, like, both almost knocked out, and Caveman lays face down in the muddy ditch and has a realization as he's passing out, wait, you need water to make mud. Which, again, I don't know as a 14-year-old, if I'm like on the brink of death, that I would realize this.
I don't know that I would either, honestly. I mean, I was thinking that. I just, every time he would think something, I'm like, yeah, that, you know, that's really smart.
Right?
Because I don't know that I would intuitively just like jump to that conclusion.
Right. So he crawls in the direction of like the muddiest part. He's like, let me get to the muddiest part because that's where the water must be. And using his hands, he literally digs like 2 feet deep or something to get to the water, which is really impressive. They talk about how tired his hands are. And finally finds, he gets the water, gives some to Zero too. Dirty, disgusting water, but it's water. And finds an onion. And yeah, so he's found Sam's onion farm. He eats half an onion, gives the other half to Zero. Zero asks, what is it? He says, a hot fudge sundae. He's so cute.
So cute.
they spend like 2 weeks up here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly, while they're spending this time up here, this is when we get Zero's confession.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, I think in the movie, it happens much earlier, right?
I'm not sure. I thought it was around this time.
I feel like it happens in the tent, doesn't it? When he's teaching him how to read?
I think that it's hinted at. I don't think that he comes out and says the entire thing. I think that happens later when they're on top of God's thumb.
Yeah, I think he like tries to say it earlier, but kind of chickens out.
Yeah, he says, I got to tell you something. And then they get like interrupted, I think. And he also makes a reference earlier in the book, like they, like he knew what kind of shoes they were. And Stanley's kind of like,
red X's.
Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, let's talk about it. So he admits it and Stanley doesn't really understand it. And finally picks up what he's putting down. And it says, Zero's confession seemed to bring him some relief. The muscles in his face relaxed. As he drifted into sleep, Stanley softly sang him the song that had been in his family for generations. So now, of course, that was actually kind of a Freudian slip. Of course, the curse is broken after he sings it. But outside of that, I just want to point out like how beautifully they care for each other. These little boys are so gentle and nice. He's singing his best friend to sleep because he's in such a, you know, distraught, horrific state. And he's just trying to like keep him motivated and comfortable. And like, isn't it nice to see such a gentle side from young boys?
It's a really nice, like gentle masculinity.
Yes.
That we don't see a whole lot, you know, that these boys are obviously tough. They're rough. They're tough. Like they can survive, but they're not going to lose this part of themselves that can show love and affection to, I mean, especially to another boy. That's, you know, that at that age, that's hard to overcome, I would think, especially given, let's also put this in the context of 1998, where, you know, the height of like homophobic type jokes being made, you know, oh, like you're so gay. Like if you did something
no homo.
Yeah. No homo. So,
do we think that's why they changed it in the movie? Cause he doesn't sing in the movie. He's not singing to.
Right. He's just like singing up at the sky or something.
He's singing to himself.
Yeah.
And that still counts.
Yeah.
For the curse.
Well, I think you're right. I think that is why they changed it. Cause it seems too quote unquote like gay or whatever.
The time period couldn't handle that friendship. You know?
Yeah.
Probably they knew that the boys of that time wouldn't relate to it. So,
but man, I think it's so sweet. I love to see it.
It's very sweet.
That's going to conclude our episode today, but final thoughts. I haven't heard much from you, Kristen. Is there anything you didn't get to say from these last few chapters?
Not really. Honestly, I felt like everything, I feel like we covered everything. Like there's so much of this second half is their journey and what an excruciating journey it was. But plot-wise, I feel like we covered everything. There's a lot of really good stuff in this. And I, like you, teared up once or twice because of it's all the flashback stuff. That's what gets me.
I mean, I know we covered this in the last episode, but reading the scene between, you know, Kate and Sam and his demise, I don't know about y'all, but as I was reading it, I knew how it ended and was hoping and praying it would end differently.
Yeah.
Even knowing, you know, what was going to happen, because I was like, this is just devastating.
I agree. Yeah. I didn't think I would cry that way. I was crying the whole way through for almost like 3 pages, actually.
Yeah.
They really gave a depth to that relationship that I didn't see in the movie. The movie already painted it well, but because of time constraints, they can't make it as compelling. But man, the book, I was crying.
It's really interesting because it's not that many pages of their story.
Mm-mm.
And so the way that he was able to tell such a compelling story within a small number of pages is just really impressive.
It was very economical.
Yeah.
Well, I think we can close it out here. As always, we never have a finishing tagline, but
keep digging.
giving y'all a thumbs up from over here.
Find your onions.
Thanks so much for listening. If you have the time, guys, please rate and review us. It would mean the world. It bumps us up in the algorithm as a new podcast. It's huge. Also, word of mouth is going to be the biggest way to share this podcast. So if you know any decrepit millennials that need a little slice of happiness in their life, a little bump of nostalgia, please, please share with them. We would super appreciate it. All right. Tune in soon for the next episode. We love you.